Welcome to the Sanity Interview by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we speak to the people that you want to hear from.
We're joined this week by Ilan Werman, who is the Julius E. Davis Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches administrative and constitutional law. He's the author of several books, including his upcoming work, The Constitution of 1789, A New Introduction. So, Ilan, thank you very much for being here. There's a lot to talk to you about, and hopefully we'll get to all of the issues that we want to touch on. I want to start with the issue of birthright citizenship. The president signed an executive order back in January to end birthright citizenship as we know it in the United States. It's now going to be heard by the Supreme Court. And you wrote a really great piece in Compact Magazine giving your view of whether or not he'll succeed and your sense that it's not as constitutional as people might think it is to be born in this country and to have automatic citizenship. So would you just lay out your understanding of that, of the 14th Amendment and what it means and what it doesn't mean and where you think this case is headed?
Sure thing. Thanks both of you for having me on to talk about this and other topics, which I'm very excited to get to. The conventional wisdom is that constitutional birthright citizenship, that the common law and the language of the 14th Amendment means that merely if you're born on United States soil, mere birth on soil creates this thing called birthright citizenship. There are some exceptions for ambassadors and invading armies, which are a bit challenging to explain if that's the rule. And what I've argued in my scholarship and what I, in summary form, argue in this Compact Magazine piece is that that's not actually the rule. That the rule at common law had always been birth on the sovereign soil to parents under the sovereign's protection. And that's very important. In exchange for that protection, the parents give allegiance to the sovereign. This is called a mutual compact, the cases call it, a mutual compact of protection and allegiance. So why is this important? Well, it explains why invading armies are excluded. So in the leading case, common law case from 1608, Sir Edward Coke said that the children born of soldiers of invading armies, although born on the king's soil, were not birthright subjects because they were not born to parents under the protection of the king. The exception for ambassadors was similar. So why is this important? Why is it important to be precise about the rule? Not mere birth on soil, but birth on soil to parents under the sovereign's protection. Well, because in the relevant periods of English history, there were only two ways to be brought as an alien under the sovereign's protection. You either got what was called the royal safe conduct, which was kind of like a pass to come to the country, extending the king's permission to enter and specifically granting the king's protection, or through statutes. So Magna Carta extended protections to friendly aliens unless they had been forbidden from entering. There's a statute from the realm of Edward III, from the reign of Edward III in 1353, that says, "Merchant strangers may safely and surely and under our protection come and dwell in our said realm." So why is this important? Well, because there's no reason to think that aliens who had come contrary to the laws, contrary to the permission of the sovereign, would have been under the protection of the sovereign within the meaning of the birthright rule. Now, there's a question whether that translates to jurisdiction, and there are lots of cases that show the connection between protection and jurisdiction, which is the language of the 14th Amendment.
Well, just to clarify, I read that, and what I simply read was that protection a few hundred years ago under the sovereign would be equal to an invitation, let's say, or permission to come to a country today. And therefore, if you're here illegally and you haven't had permission to come, you are not therefore guaranteed birthright citizenship for your children. Would that be the argument you're making?
That's exactly right. We don't know how they would have ruled had there been somebody who came unlawfully without a safe conduct or without statutory permission, because there wasn't such a case. But we do know that the safe conducts issued by the king and that the statutes, Magna Carta, Carta Mercatoria, the statute of Edward III, extended permission and protection together. So as far as we know, there were only two ways to be brought under the king's protection. One was a safe conduct, royal permission. The other was statutory permission. And so it just wouldn't translate to people who are unlawfully here. That's correct.
What about how do you understand the language subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is the kind of key phrase? You know, so a lot of folks who argue in favor of birthright citizenship say, well, you know, if someone's born here, they're subject to the jurisdiction, right? They have to obey the laws. They can be arrested if they don't. They're subject to kind of penal code. So what do you see the valence of that phrase and its meaning?
So jurisdiction is actually an ambiguous term. So courts, for example, exercise a general jurisdiction over people who are domiciled in the state of where the court sits, but they only exercise specific jurisdiction over other individuals. Well, those are two different kinds of jurisdictions. The founders, the framers of the 14th Amendment, told us what they meant. The idea here was to exclude the Indian tribes. So people, Native Americans born to Indian tribes under tribal authority, were understood to be partially subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. The United States exercised some jurisdiction, including criminal jurisdiction, over the Indian tribes, but it wasn't a complete jurisdiction. So that's what they told us. The drafters told us that what we mean is a complete legislative, executive, and judicial jurisdiction. So merely because somebody is subject to the criminal laws doesn't mean that they're subject to this full and complete jurisdiction in the relevant sense. So there's this interesting case that arose out of the War of 1812. And what Chancellor Kent, very famous, what he said in this case, he said, a lawful residence, this is great, this is a great line, a lawful residence implies protection and a capacity to sue and be sued. In other words, being under the sovereign's protection is what gave you the right to access the sovereign's courts, to sue on, to enter into contracts and to sue on your contracts. So put another way, an illegal alien caught at the border can be subject to our criminal jurisdiction. I mean, he could just be turned away, but he could be subject to our criminal jurisdiction. Does it follow that that alien, that that individual has to be allowed to enter into contracts while present in the United States, that he has to be allowed to sue and be sued? So in this sense, people who come without the king's permission or the sovereign's permission, without the sovereign's protection, are not subject to the benefits of the jurisdiction in the relevant sense. So permission was essential for protection, and protection was a condition precedent for a complete jurisdiction over the individual.
So we've had Supreme Court rulings on matters related to birthright citizenship. We have federal statutes. And how did those impact your argument one way or the other? And assuming that, let's say, this goes to the Supreme Court and President Trump wins, would we have to have a constitutional amendment? Would Congress have to? What would have to happen then? Or is the Supreme Court, you know, ruling enough to cancel out this idea of birthright citizenship?
Okay, so that question, well, so three questions. Let's start with the precedent. There is a case called Wankemark that everybody thinks establishes the conventional wisdom, but the Supreme Court in Wankemark was very clear that they were dealing with domiciled parents, permanent residents, who are lawfully there. We don't know what the court would have said if those conditions didn't hold, but you know that's the case that we have now. But we do know what they said when they were lawfully there and permanently domiciled. The court said Wankemark's parents, while lawfully permitted to remain in the United States, were under the protection of the United States and consequently subject to its jurisdiction. So in that case, it's not this long-standing precedent. Now, the Supreme Court has in four or five cases over the 50s, 60s, and 70s presumed, but hasn't decided, that somebody born in the United States, irrespective of whether their parents, you know, were illegal or not, illegally present or not, were citizens, but it was never litigated. It was just presumed. And I don't think it actually became Department of State policy in the manuals until the 80s or 90s. So this is not some long-standing precedent. Now, the statutory question is interesting. There is a statute that deals with birthright citizenship, but it just parrots the language of the amendment. So it says, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, in the cases before the Supreme Court, it has been argued that the drafters believed at the time, there's legislative history showing that they believed that that included people unlawfully there. So could the Supreme Court avoid the constitutional question by saying, well, the Congress in the 1950s, when it passed the statute, believed subject to the jurisdiction as a statutory matter included people born here to unlawfully present aliens? Maybe, but it's awkward because the Supreme Court doesn't like to do legislative history anymore. So it kind of puts them between a rock and a hard place. So I would be surprised if the court takes an out here with the statute. I think it's probably going to decide on the constitutional ruling. And that would mean it would leave it up to Congress to to get to your final question, which is, if Congress wants to expand birthright citizenship, if it wants to tailor birthright citizenship, for example, to the children of dreamers, but exclude people who are excludable, who were just caught at the border, I think Congress should be able to have that flexibility.
Mm-hmm. And what about the sort of reliance question? I mean, would people who were born here and assume that they had birthright citizenship, would there be kind of legal weight to that? I don't know exactly how would the executive order kind of play into that? Is that something courts historically have taken into account in terms of making constitutional decisions?
That's a great question. The executive order, as you suggest, only applies prospectively. But if the court rules in a certain way, is the implication that it could be applied retroactively? And in that situation, what do we do with expectation values and settlement values? And I don't know. I mean, the Supreme Court, before overturning precedent, does consider things like reliance interests. But in this case, again, why would we disable Congress? So I don't know what the court's going to do, is the short answer, certainly with respect to the retrospective problem. But even if it casts doubt on the status of those individuals, why can't Congress take action and pass a law like the Birthright Citizenship Protection Act or the Birthright Citizenship Expansion Act? So let's take the example of same-sex marriage. In 2022, Congress passed a law. I think it was called the Respect for Marriage Act. I can't remember exactly. Anticipating that on the off chance the Supreme Court reverses the Obergefell decision, that Congress wants to recognize as a matter of federal law all of the existing marriages that were entered into under the reliance of that decision. Congress could, of course, do something similar here. But I would just caution the Supreme Court against doing a one-size-fits-all, well, we're not going to make it retroactive because of reliance interests, because that feels like legislating rather than just telling us what the law is. And you never know what the individual circumstances of particular persons are. And so it's unclear why this shouldn't be decided on a case-by-case basis or why it should not be decided legislatively.
Let me ask you just as a quick follow-up in terms of your own intellectual journey on this question. I mean, what was your trajectory? I mean, did you start off being someone who said, oh yeah, of course birthright citizenship is constitutional, everyone knows that, and then you started, looking in the Plantagenet sources and you got back? Or did you start from another direction? It kind of feels a little bit along like it's sort of you against the world on this question, or at least was for a while. And maybe now the world has caught up to you. But how did that sort of process work?
So I do have a tweet from 2018 that someone threw in my face recently, in which I say something like, well, of course it applies to anybody here, including, children of illegal aliens. But I've changed my mind about a lot of things once I have studied them. So and that should be – that's a virtue, I think. So for example, and then I'll come back to the birthright citizenship point, but I used to think that this grant of executive power to the president in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution was this vast residuum of all royal prerogative powers, giving the president all of these sorts of inherent foreign affairs and war powers. A lot of originalists, formalists, conservative legal thinkers believe that. And then I read something by Professor Julian Mortensen at the University of Michigan that convinced me that that was wrong, that it's only the power to execute law. And, the implications are a bit different, I think, than what he suggests. But when I study something and become more of an expert on something, you have to be open to changing your mind. A big one, and I'm going to get, I'm not going to get in trouble here, but I've already published this. Incorporation of the Bill of Rights against the states. Historically, the Bill of Rights only bound the federal government. It did not bind the state governments. And for a long time, I believed, like the conventional wisdom, that the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, so a related clause to the one we're talking about, was intended to make the Bill of Rights applicable to the states. And then I read about it. I read all the work. I read all the literature, all the history, and I decided everybody was wrong about that. And so I wrote a book called The Second Founding, where I basically argue that the 14th Amendment was not intended to do this. Now, to answer your birthright citizenship question, it sort of started in 2020 with that book. This concept of protection for allegiance, which is critical to the rule of birthright subjectship, a common law or birthright citizenship, is relevant to the Equal Protection Clause, because the Equal Protection Clause talks about protection. What is protection of the law? And so there was a lot of literature about protection for allegiance. Protection of the law is this exchange. It's this social compact that you get in exchange for obeying the sovereign, for leaving the state of nature and agreeing to give allegiance to this political society, right? The bargain is that they have to protect you. Otherwise, why would you leave the state of nature? Well, that obviously relates to the common law question of protection and allegiance. And so I had seen some material about this. But Ari, why would I have published it? Why would I have published it? In 2020, I wasn't tenured. Okay. In 2020, this wasn't really a live issue. I mean, the Trump administration sort of had tried to do this. Okay. Like, why would I have stuck my neck out there, right? And suffered serious academic consequences. Okay. Well, I am tenured now. And even then, you know, I was a bit hesitant to pursue the materials that I had found because there are academic consequences, right? Academia is not this, you know, it's a wonderful place and I love where I am, but it's not this like open debate, intellectual ideas. It's getting better, I think. And certainly my colleagues at the University of Minnesota certainly believe in that genuine academic debate and intellectual freedom, but there are consequences. So I have to be prepared to spend the rest of my life where I am in the bitter cold of Minnesota. Okay. It's actually not that bad. The winter is really not that bad. So you have to make a calculation. I had tenure. The administration did this, which it really did not do the first time around. So there would have been a reason to do it. It would have advanced the public debate. And so I decided to take the plunge and to get my materials together and to write something about it. And so, you know, I do not lose any sleep at night over having done this, even though I have gotten a lot of flack and a lot of hate and disdain from academics who really should know better, who really should treat the academic enterprise much more liberally and generously than they do.
You make me want to send my kids to the University of Minnesota all of a sudden.
Well, can I do one more tiny follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
At least the law school. At least the law school.
So is your argument that on the kind of loyalty issue or sort of, I forget what term?
Allegiance.
Sorry. So if a parent is an illegal immigrant, is that sort of definitionally, inherently, they cannot claim allegiance to the American sovereign? And is that because they still have an allegiance to the country they came to, or the fact of their illegal entry renders impossible the allegiance to America?
Or can I add to that just for the non-lawyers among us, right? That word allegiance makes sense a few hundred years ago, and you think of it as actual allegiance to a sovereign, but I'm hearing it in modern parlance as permission. Right. So if you don't think of it as allegiance like loyalty, but you think of it allegiance equals permission to even be here, doesn't that answer the question? But I'm going to ask you to answer the question.
Yeah, those are both very astute questions. And we have to be careful about how we use the word allegiance, because I'm actually using it in a slightly older term. So allegiance had this dual meaning at common law. It meant a loyalty, a fidelity to the king, and aliens could have that allegiance. It didn't have to be, I pledge allegiance, you know, you're my sovereign, I'm never going to go back. That's not what the sources say. The idea is that lawful aliens with permission to be in the realm were within the allegiance of the sovereign because they entered into this mutual compact. It was held to be temporary, while an alien who had a permanent allegiance to his home sovereign, when he was in a foreign land or in the land of England, he received a temporary protection from the king, in exchange for which he owed the king a temporary allegiance or loyalty or fidelity. Now, allegiance also meant simply being within the power of the king. So you'll see a lot of language that says, oh, you're born within the allegiance of the king. That just meant in the king's territory, subject to the king's power. Okay. But allegiance didn't come out of nowhere. Allegiance emerged or derived from this mutual compact between sovereign and subject, or sovereign and alien. It's this idea that because I give you protection, you owe me allegiance. But the king didn't have to give protection in the first place. Right? An alien could not just unilaterally enter into this mutual compact and say, oh, I give you allegiance, therefore my children are birthright citizens. Well, no, it was a mutual compact between the king and the subject. Aliens could be subject to that mutual compact. And Sir Edward Coke, in Calvin's case, the leading common law case, said aliens who entered into this mutual compact, protection for allegiance, were temporarily subjects of the king. They were natural subjects of the king while in the realm, such that their children were natural born subjects. So it's very, you know, easy to go astray if you just think about allegiance. And if you just think about allegiance in the 21st century sense of the word, it's like, oh, I pledge my loyalty. I want to be an American. That's not what it's about. It's this mutual compact, protection for allegiance. and protection required the sovereign's permission or consent to enter. And protection was also a precondition for jurisdiction, which is the actual language of the amendment. So this gets very technical and very legal, but I think, you know, the debates have to be technical and somewhat legal.
Okay, you mentioned Minnesota, where you teach, and you may have noticed there's a lot going on in Minnesota right now in terms of groups of immigrants, and in particular, there's this large scandal surrounding welfare spending and fraud. And you had an interesting insight into whether or not federal government can spend money on welfare programs. And I wonder if you could just give us a brief on that, because I thought it was really an interesting way to look at what's happening right now in the news.
Speaking of academia, I got a lot of hate and disdain for having posted on X this idea, which I do think is actually my edgiest constitutional view. I'm an originalist. I believe we're bound by the original meaning of the Constitution. And under the original meaning of the Constitution, there is a serious question whether Congress has the power to spend money on welfare programs. Now, Congress has the necessary and proper power to spend money in furtherance of its enumerated powers. So Congress has the power to establish a military and to pay for the military. And that's why it can make, you know, veterans' pensions. So an early statute, the invalid veterans of the Revolutionary War were given pensions. I'm not casting doubt. You know, government employees can get pensions, things like that. So there are welfare programs consistent with the necessary and proper clause. But the question is, where does Congress get the power to spend money beyond its enumeration of power? That's the question. Because go through the list, commerce, the Commerce Clause, the Post Office Clause, the Military Clause, you know, all of these foreign affairs related clauses, where does it give Congress the power to establish, say, a Social Security program, right? Or a food, you know, give money for state programs for childcare? Well, the theory is the first clause in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, where the enumeration of power is, gives Congress the power to spend for the general welfare. That's the idea. That's the belief. The Supreme Court told us Congress had that power in 1936, okay, the New Deal. But that's not what the clause actually says. The clause is a power to tax, not a power to spend. It's a power to raise money through the mode of taxation so that you could then spend on your enumerated powers. Okay, so the clause, if I may, this gets technical, so you stop me if you have to. The clause, and I'm working off of memory, okay, says Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, comma, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, semicolon, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Okay, that's what the clause says. Well, here's the thing. If there was a semicolon instead of a comma, right, Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, semicolon, and to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, then maybe these would be two different powers, a power to tax and a power to spend, provide for the general welfare. And if there was no comma, then there's no question that Congress would have power to tax for those purposes, right? So you can only tax for national purposes. But there's a comma, so it's confusing. But when you look at the language of the clause, it clearly has to be only a power to tax, only a power to raise money, not an independent power to spend for the general welfare, to make these welfare programs. Why? Well, first of all, there's that modification at the end, right? All excises and imposts and duties shall be uniform. It's clearly it modifies taxing, right? Why would you have a power to pay the debts of the United States? Congress already has a power to borrow money, which means you have to pay them back, right? The whole clause, okay, is a clause to tax for national purposes, which makes sense because it replaced a similar clause in the Articles of Confederation that allowed the Confederation Congress to requisition money from the states for national purposes, right? So that it could spend on its powers that it had under the Articles of Confederation. Of course, the states didn't give the money. We had the Constitutional Convention. One of the most important powers was that Congress would have the power to tax the people directly, but only for national purposes. Right? So it's a clause about raising money, which can then only be spent on the enumerated powers, right? Which are the national purposes assigned to Congress. It is not a power to generally spend for the general welfare. Now look, this was debated for a long time. Alexander Hamilton had the broader view and did think there was an independent power to spend for the general welfare. But I don't know. I'm edgy. I'm pretty strict interpreter of the Constitution. I go where the original history leads me. And I think the better reading of the Constitution is that there's only a taxing power. Now, is it likely that the Supreme Court's going to say Social Security is unconstitutional? Highly doubt it.
But here's a dumb question.
Let me stop there.
But if you know, presumably Social Security was established by statute, right? Doesn't it then become a power of Congress? I mean,
no. You almost like I planted this question because it is a perfect explanation of what's happening. Congress can only do what's in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, right? Congress can establish post office, establish a military, right? It can define offenses against the law of nations, right? It can provide for calling forth the militia, which it did in the Insurrection Act, which is also relevant in Minnesota. It could do all of those things. It cannot just create a program to spend money unless something in the Constitution authorizes it to do so. And my claim is, the clause in Article 1, Section 8 allows Congress to raise money by taxes. Article 1, Section 8 does not say anything about how Congress is allowed to spend that money. That has to come from elsewhere in the Constitution, and you have to find it in the enumeration, you have to find it in the necessary and proper clause, and there's nothing in the enumeration that allows Congress to create a federal welfare program throughout the United States that is not tethered to some enumerated power. So Congress did it by statute. But Congress can't do by statute things that exceed the Constitution. And I think it exceeds the Constitution here. Again, this is my edgiest view. Okay, it's absolutely my edgiest view, but I feel like this session of your podcast is all about edgy constitution.
Well, I mean, and even someone as edgy as President Trump and who loves controversy, I think I find it hard to imagine that even he would try to bring this up, or do you think that he might?
Wait a second. Well, you mentioned the Insurrection Act. You mentioned that as a congressional power. So what's the deal? What's the deal with the president threatening to or promising to invoke the Insurrection Act?
But Rebecca, just to answer that question, Republicans and Democrats, everybody loves spending money.
Yes,
because you get voters that way. I think the Republican view is that Democrats are just better at it.
Right. Like Rand Paul might take you up on your idea, right? But he's maybe the only one I can think of.
Maybe the only one. That's right. Okay. Well, so the Insurrection Act is super interesting. So Trump is threatening to invoke it. So what is the Insurrection Act? It's actually pretty unfortunately named because the statute doesn't just talk about insurrection. So Article 1 of the Constitution, to go to Ari's question, says that Congress shall have power to provide for calling forth the militia of the United States. And the militia is just the body of the people. Today we think of it as the National Guard, but it was the body of the people to do three things. You can suppress rebellion or insurrection, you can repel invasion, or you can't enforce the laws of the Union. So Congress in 1792 in the Militia Act, which was then amended in 1795 and amended again in 1807, and today it's called the Insurrection Act. But in this Militia Act, Congress provided the conditions under which the president may call forth the militia, today the National Guard, to do these three things. And the statute has rebellion in it. But it doesn't just have rebellion in it. It says whenever there are unlawful combinations, assemblages, or obstructions that make it impracticable to enforce the laws of the United States through the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, the president can call forth the militia to help execute the law. Now, the president has to make a proclamation. He has to order the disturbers to disperse before he can do this. So does there have to be a rebellion in Minnesota, an insurrection in Minnesota, for the president to call forth the militia, the National Guard, under this statute? No. There just has to be assemblages and obstructions and combinations that are making it impracticable to enforce the law by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Are there obstructions, assemblages, combinations that are interfering with federal law enforcement? Yes, of course there are. Are there, is it impracticable to enforce the laws through the ordinary course of judicial proceedings? That might be debated. The president's going to get a lot of deference, I think, on this. But, you know, when you're live in a street corner and you've got a bunch of protesters blocking ICE officers, it's not exactly easy to just run to a court and say, hey, can we get an injunction telling them to disperse? Or can, you know, you can't, it's implausible to think that the ordinary course of judicial proceedings really is effective in that situation. Now they could all be arrested and prosecuted pursuant to the ordinary course of judicial process, but then you're going to need 10,000 officers, not 3,000 officers, right?
The president's deployment of National Guard in other cities received sort of judicial pushback? Is that on the same grounds or different, or what's been the kind of snag there?
That is an excellent question. The administration has used a different statute, which how that statute actually interacts with the Militia Act that we're talking about now, or the Insurrection Act, is actually a really interesting question. The more modern statute that President Trump relied on was about federalizing the National Guard, which again, the militia is the National Guard, or the National Guard is the militia. So it's how do these statutes interact is interesting. But that newer statute they were relying on really requires that the governor ask for assistance. It says that the regular forces can't be, for whatever reason, used. And of course, the military is going to be effective. It's kind of perverse, right? We kind of want the National Guard instead of the military, but the statute says, you know, you have to try to use the regular forces first, whatever that means. And so through this combination of weird things in that statute, the Supreme Court held that Trump did not have power to federalize the National Guard in these states. I'm not sure the court's interpretation was correct, but this statute is different. It doesn't say anything about using the regular forces. It says you could use the militia or the armed forces.
So maybe Trump should have used the Insurrection Act in all the other cases, right?
So I call it the Militia Act. Everybody else calls it.
I think you should start calling it the Militia Act, actually, for just from a PR perspective.
Yeah, of course you can use it. Of course.
But so in other words, if he uses that Militia Act in this case, there's little to anything that Governor Walz or any other, you know, law enforcement official in the state can do.
I think that's right. Now, how would the courts adjudicate this? And I love talking about this. So one of the first times the militia was called was in the War of 1812. And a guy named Jacob Mott thought that James Madison did not have authority to call forth the militia. So he refused the call. He didn't show up. He was court-martialed in absentia. He was fined, and then he didn't pay the fine. So the local sheriff seized his horse in order to sell to pay the fine. And Jacob Mott sued the sheriff for unlawful conversion of property. And then the sheriff defends on the ground that the seizure was lawful because of President Madison's order was lawful. And then it was adjudicated in the Supreme Court that way. Now, that sounds a little kind of crazy, but think about it. That's how judicial power is supposed to work. Judicial power is invoked when somebody is injured in some way, when somebody has a private injury. And it might sound crazy today, but it seems crazier to me to say that a district judge, one of 600 around the country, can second guess the president's determination on the fly as to whether the conditions exist to invoke the Insurrection Act. So I think Trump is on pretty solid legal footing to invoke the so-called Insurrection Act, what we call the Militia Act, but we'll see what happens.
Okay, we have so much we want to get to with you, so maybe we'll just do a little bit of a speed round, you know. What's your take on the tariffs case? Speaking of presidential power.
That's difficult, and I have no idea what they're going to do. I'm very bad at prognosticating because on the one hand, there's this major questions doctrine. The court really wants Congress to do a lot of the legislating. On the other hand, this kind of is at the intersection of foreign affairs, and they've said that the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine has less force in foreign affairs. But still, back on the original hand, Congress has the power to regulate foreign commerce. So I have a feeling they are going to strike it down, but they're giving Trump enough time to rewrite the tariffs so that they're consistent with other statutory authority that is more specific. And maybe that means some of the tariffs go by the wayside. And so there's some win, you know, for Trump, but some of them go away. That's my guess as to what will happen, but I really have no idea.
I was actually really interested in that, in the orals that a little bit that I listened to, that Justice Barrett actually was concerning herself with what the implications would be if the tariffs were struck down to the economy and to society. And I just wondered, does that factor into her legal decision making, or is she just curious? Or
I hope not. Again, I'm a formalist. I care about formal legal rules. I care about text. I care about structure. I care about history. Consequences can, of course, come into play to the extent that a statutory provision or a constitutional provision is ambiguous, right? if you read an ambiguous provision in a way that leads to insane consequences, probably that means the provision wasn't supposed to be that or to mean that. But people could see it both ways as to the consequences of the tariffs here. There are going to be people who see it every which way. And so I really hope she just focuses on formal legal rules rather than her anticipation of what the consequences might be.
Mm-hmm. And finally, maybe, do you think, does the president have the ability to fire a director of the Fed?
Finally, in the lightning round, this is like one of my core areas of scholarship. I've written articles about this. It's going to be in a couple.
And just chapters this hearing is coming up next week, so it's really a perfect.
This is the
timing.
Case of Lisa Cook, who's on the board of governors and who was removed, I think, for cause, and she's fighting it, and we're waiting to hear.
Well, since this is an edgy podcast session, I will be edgy. So in brief, there's a related case called Trump against Slaughter, where the Supreme Court, 6-3, is going to rule that the president has the power to remove all principal officers, including those in independent agencies. So this headless fourth branch, the administrative state, is more or less going to go away to the extent we believe that the president's ability to fire them will undermine their independence. There's some reason to question that, but anyway, the president is going to have this power to fire principal officers in independent agencies. The question in Trump v. Cook is whether the Federal Reserve is different. Is it special? The Supreme Court has hinted on its interim docket, its so-called shadow docket, that the Fed is different. But why? Why? The Federal Reserve has tremendous regulatory power against banks. It caps how much they can loan, what the reserves have to be. And so they have tremendous regulatory power. It's true that historically there was a Bank of the United States that was not understood to be sort of this regulatory agency, and the president didn't have the power to fire all the directors. But the Bank of the United States was just a bank. It was just a bank. It was engaged in private activity. It's true it was a very important bank because the United States deposited its treasury funds into the national bank, into the Bank of the United States, which allowed them to create this uniform national currency through banknotes. Okay, but just because that's important doesn't mean it's any less just a private actor exercising a private function, serving as a bank. So the Federal Reserve has some qualities that are kind of like that, but as long as it has its tremendous regulatory authority, and it does have tremendous regulatory authority, there's no exception in the Constitution to the Federal Reserve. And it would be surprising if there was, since paper money is probably unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Okay, that was that's the juiciest one of all.
That's up the sun's alley. I mean, we're a gold standard.
I just want to ask one clarifying question for myself. So there was a lot of to-do about the fact that Lisa Cook committed or is alleged to have committed mortgage fraud. And people were saying, how could you sit on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and actually not steward your own money properly, et cetera. But so you're saying that question is actually irrelevant. Even if she were convicted of mortgage fraud, that's not relevant to this question about whether or not the executive has authority over the Federal Reserve in the first place.
Well, so it doesn't have to be relevant depending on how the court decides the case. So the court could say the Fed isn't different. Trump could fire her for any reason, end of case. If it doesn't want to say that, it could say a number of other things. It could say, well, whatever for cause is, being credibly accused of mortgage fraud is cause. Okay, but that's also tricky because, you know, is it really just enough for the president? You know, Lisa Cook says these accusations are false. President Taft, when he effectuated some for-cause removals in like 1912, I think it was, or 1913, had an internal executive branch adjudication to determine cause. So there's a lot of things that the court just hasn't thought about if it wants to go that route. So it may want to avoid the constitutional question, but the constitutional question is the cleanest way to solve this, to say the Fed actually isn't different, so long as it has this regulatory authority. But I have no idea what it's going to do, Rebecca.
Okay. Ilan, we have to have you back to talk about the unconstitutional nature of our money.
Or just maybe in June, when all these decisions come down, we'll do a review. But Ilan, thank you so much.
Thank you both. Love to come back.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.